From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Joe Klein knows Bill Clinton. In his book Primary Colors, Klein took an anonymous look at a fictionalized Bill Clinton's first bid for the White House and painted a picture of suspense, sex, and determined idealism amid it all. But as the saying goes, truth is stranger than fiction. Case in point, the Clinton White House. Now, Joe Klein is out with a new book about the real President Clinton. He's out of the woods. He's got the zeitgeist, and he doesn't hold back. In this hour, Joe Klein on the Clinton presidency, the good, the bad, and the downright ugly. We begin tonight in Washington, where after 7 years of wrangling, the Senate passes a campaign finance bill. Gail Chadwick covers Congress for the Christian Science Monitor and joins us now with the latest. Gail, what's it all mean? What's happened today, and where is it sending it?
Well, it's the end of what seems like a very long battle. I think that the mood today among people like Shays and Meehan, who've been fighting this for 7 years, was muted triumph. Happy it's over, but there really is a sense that it was a very long siege. And where has it left us is really up to two groups, the courts and the Federal Election Commission. The courts, they're going to decide how much of this bill actually remains law after a suit that begins almost immediately. And the Federal Election Commission, because they have to write some rules that are going to be really important in the end. But the initial sense is that we have at least eliminated soft money contributions to national political parties, which have been so publicized recently, you know, the White House dinners. You're talking about Joe Klein later on in this hour. Mm-hmm. I'm sure he'll go back to some of that. The idea of a senator calling up someone and asking for a $1 million contribution that I think really soured politics for a lot of people.
Is that or will that now be a thing of the past, Gail Chadwick?
In a direct form, it will be. That is, I can no longer call up and say, mail $1 million to the DNC. I can say, mail $1 million to Donkeys R Us, a new outside group that has just formed. And that, of course, is the concern, that money is in politics to stay. We've got a $2 trillion budget that means a lot to a lot of groups, and they'll find other ways to influence those outcomes.
The lobbying will always be there, and you've told us before that this is a finger in the dike, and the dike will spring other leaks, but it's a big finger in the dike tonight. Gail, you talked about this being taken to the courts immediately. Who will take this legislation before the courts to try and fight it there, and what might they achieve?
Well, Mitch McConnell has just gave a briefing a couple of hours ago where he said he's announcing his legal team later this week. He promises that it will be a very excellent team that will indicate the seriousness of his intent. And
this is the Republican senator from Kentucky.
That's right, mm-hmm. Who has really been single-handedly fought this for these long 7 years.
And will it be fought on a freedom of speech approach?
Right. Really, First Amendment. The court in its landmark Buckley v. Valeo case made a connection between speech and money that the senator is going to go back and push on again. In restricting the amount of money that you can give to national political parties, are you not, in fact, restricting speech? That's mm-hmm. going to be his push. There are other features as well that some people think are perhaps even more vulnerable to a court challenge, including restrictions on how much money outside groups can spend 60 days prior to a general election that names a candidate.
And as for the Federal Election Commission, which would actually apply the law, how much leeway will they have in that application?
Well, they have quite a bit, actually. The important rule that they're going to have to write is a rule that deals with the amount of coordination that is appropriate between lawmakers and these outside groups. If, for example, the fictitious group I just invented, Elephants R Us, attacks my opponent in an election, and my chief aide has spending virtually full time in Elephants R Us office.
Mm-hmm.
According to the new rule, that should raise some eyebrows. But how do you write such a rule? How do you write it in such a way that if I have lunch with someone with Elephants R Us because we're a member of the same club, it's not coordination? That's not going to be an easy rule to write, and I think people are watching it very closely.
It's going to be hard to catch all the dollars. Gail, it was a 60-40 vote today, I believe. How did the party lines express themselves in this vote?
I think there were 11 Republicans that shifted over and voted for this in the end, and two Democrats. I've actually got this right here.
So how do you expect this will affect the elections this fall?
Well, it won't. That is, it doesn't kick in until November 6th.
I guess even beyond the money itself, the sort of party, the public applause for the party that helped push it through, in this case the Democrats, or do you think the public is just not that tuned in? Do you think it will be a factor in the way people vote?
That is, of course, the most important question. What kind of legs does this issue have? There's a lot of grassroots activity around this, in part because it took so long. You know, Granny D mm-hmm. walking across the country, a lot of college groups that are pushing this issue as well. Issues like, will we then see a push for public funding of campaigns altogether, or more free television time? I mean, those are the questions that will indicate the kind of legs that it has. And yes, I think it might impact the election. Although this election, as so many before, it doesn't look like it's going to have very many contested seats, which, of course, is the reason for
part and parcel of
in the first place.
Right. Gil Chadwick, it's something we're going to have to watch for a long, long time, no question about it. But thanks for coming on with the latest developments for us tonight.
Appreciate it.
Gil Chadwick covers Congress for the Christian Science Monitor. We're talking this hour about the Clinton presidency, beyond the scandal to the resonance today of Bill Clinton's 8 years in the White House. He was the man from Hope, well, actually Hot Springs, Arkansas, who raised the nation's hopes and dashed them at the same time. He ushered in an era of economic prosperity and another of unfathomable personal failings. Bill Clinton brought the nation together after Oklahoma City, lied about what he did with that woman, and passed out presidential pardons like candy to the likes of reviled financier Mark Rich. In his new book, The Natural, The Misunderstood Presidency of Bill Clinton, political analyst and author Joe Klein takes the Clinton complexity head on. He opens the door with a quote from George Santayana on William James that would surely apply to William Jefferson Clinton. He was so extremely natural that there was no knowing what his nature was, or what came next. 14 months after Clinton's 8 years, what do you make of the nature, the imprint of the man? What is our Clinton legacy? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from New York is Joe Klein, author of The Natural, The Misunderstood Presidency of Bill Clinton. He also wrote Primary Colors, first as anonymous, and later came out to claim that book. He's a staff writer for The New Yorker magazine. Good evening and welcome, Joe Klein.
Hi, good to be here.
Thanks for joining us, Joe. There's so much to get into here tonight, Joe Klein, but give us a sense first, so we understand where you're coming from, of your personal relationship with Bill Clinton. When did it begin? What was the texture of it? Where does it stand today?
Well, I met him in 1989, and my first relationship with him was me as reporter, he as policy library. You know, you could call
he
him
knew it all.
He knew everything. You could call him up when he was the governor of Arkansas and say, who's doing interesting stuff in housing? And he'd tell you what all 50 governors were doing in housing or in education or in welfare policy. The guy was just amazing. And then when I saw that he actually could speak on the stump and relate to audiences, I thought, wow, this guy is something else. Another part of this was that I was very interested at that point in a group of thinkers who were trying to figure out how do you make liberal governance relevant in the information age. One of the things that Clinton told me when he was governor of Arkansas, and when I think he thought that Mario Cuomo was going to be the presidential nominee, he said, the next president is going to have to figure out ways to move this country from the industrial age to the information age.
And he ultimately decided that next president ought to be him. You were there as he campaigned across the country, as he campaigned in New Hampshire. You describe in the book being there at midnight after a long, long day of reporting, playing a set of bowling with Bill Clinton in your stocking feet and him leaning up against you with a feline presence. You guys, you spent some time together.
Well, we spent some time together that night, and he was always pretty needy. Excuse me. He was known for his appetites. I would never say that we were friends.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that he has all that many friends. You know, 14 years later, I can say that I've talked to him quite a bit, And I've talked to him quite a bit since he left the presidency. And he never shows an awful lot.
Help us follow through the arc of that relationship, and then we want to hear about the man. But you had a falling out after, or I guess during, the writing of Primary Colors?
Well, no. No, I can't say that we ever had a falling in. During the 92 campaign, I was writing negative things about Bill Clinton before many people were writing positive things. And the relationship was always reporter-politician.
Okay.
His first 2 years in office, when he abandoned the new Democratic ideas or he seemed to abandon those ideas, I wrote very tough stuff about him, and he wasn't very happy about it, at least I hear through third parties. And then in 94, I started writing Primary Colors, or maybe it was 95. Mm-hmm. It was 95. And the book came out in 96. And I always saw that as a tribute to larger-than-life politicians. I mean, I sit here before you totally pro-peccadillo. I think that politicians who have interesting sex lives are more likely to succeed in office than those who don't.
We're going to have to come back to that. Bring us up to date in your relationship with Bill Clinton. Then, when was the last time you spoke with him? What was the mood?
Well, after he moved back to the center in 94, I resumed, being a fairly favorable commentator on the things that he was doing and trying to do. And toward the end of his administration, I began to go around to all the various players and ask them retrospectively what they had accomplished, what they wished they had accomplished, and so on. And he heard about this, and I bumped into him at the White House at an event one day, and he said, "I know what you're doing, and I want to help." And so we had a series of very long interviews during his last year in office. And since then, we've, talked by phone. I've seen him a couple of times. Last time I spoke with him was, I would say, late January.
Mm-hmm. You're pretty up to date. Joe Klein, I have to say, having dipped into this book, your writing style and Bill Clinton, I don't know how you take this, but there's a match made in heaven or hell here. I'm not sure which, but you really do
heaven, I hope.
Capture the man. Well, we'd like to think heaven. You write, there was a physical, almost carnal quality to his public appearances. He embraced audiences and was aroused by them in return. His sonar was remarkable in retail political situations. He seemed able to sense what audiences needed and deliver it to them, trimming his pitch here, emphasizing different priorities there, always aiming to please in a way that seems like a bottom line to the full 8 years.
Yeah, I think that the aiming to please was pathological, and it was perhaps the greatest of his many appetites. And I think that when he failed, in fact, I once told him this. I said, "I can always tell when you're going to screw up." And he looked at me and he gave me this, grimace. And he said, "How?" I said, "Well, when you have the full public, when you have the American people in mind, you're usually okay. But when you're trying to please the person who's sitting in front of you or the people sitting in front of you, like the Democratic congressional leadership his first 2 years in office, or the press, or Newt Gingrich, or whomever, then he loses track. Or, in the ultimate case, Denise Rich."
Joe Klein, I'm struck by how only 14 months after Bill Clinton left office, so many people, even those who were great supporters of Bill Clinton, just don't want to talk about him, maybe don't even want to think about him. Have you run into that? What's that about?
Well, people are buying the book.
I don't mean they won't be interested in your story, but I get the feeling it's like they ate too much rich dessert and just don't want another bite sometimes.
I don't know. I think, I was a little worried about that when the book came out. But I think that, that's one side of it. And the other side of it is that he is an ambulatory automobile accident. I mean, this is a guy who you can't stop looking at. If his picture appears on the front page of a newspaper, postage stamp size, your eye is goes directly to him. And so I think that people, are still perplexed and awed and amazed and disgusted by him. And, I think that
there is that appeal
as the news ebbs.
Joe Klein, we have to take a break, Joe. We'll come right back. We're talking about Bill Clinton tonight. We're going to plumb the depths, talk about the heights. How does Bill Clinton live in your mind today? Demon, demigod, some wild mix of both? Do you miss Bill Clinton, or do you never want to see his face, hear his voice again? You can join our conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Boston University.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with author Joe Klein about the legacy, the reality, the inside story of Bill Clinton. Let's bring back the voice of the man who was president for 8 years in the 90s. Here's a brief clip from his State of the Union address in 1997. Bill Clinton.
Whatever our differences, we should balance the budget now. And then, for the long-term health of our society, we must agree to a bipartisan process to preserve Social Security and reform Medicare for the long run, so that these fundamental programs will be as strong for our children as they are for our parents. And let me say something that's not in my script tonight. I know this is not going to be easy. But I really believe one of the reasons the American people gave me a second term was to take the tough decisions in the next 4 years that will carry our country through the next 50 years.
Bill Clinton's State of the Union address in 1997. What was America's affair with Bill Clinton all about? Did he repel you, cast a spell on you? What was it all about? Is it a relief to have someone less complex at the helm today? Or do you miss the magical mystery tour of Bill Clinton? We're talking tonight with Joe Klein. He's author of a new book, The Natural, The Misunderstood Presidency of Bill Clinton. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. Joe Klein, The Misunderstood Presidency. What was the misunderstanding?
Well, I think that you couldn't put insufficiently understood presidency on a book jacket. So, I don't know that I think that what was insufficiently understood, you talk about, let's take 1997 from the clip that we just heard. He did get a balanced budget agreement with the Republicans. We all know that.
First time in 40 years that it happened.
What was insufficiently understood was that as part of that, he got a massive $30 billion tax credit program for higher education, HOPE scholarships, and lifelong learning tax credit. 10 million people a year take advantage of this. It was a major achievement. We never reported it because we were writing that year about White House coffees and the rental of the Lincoln bedroom and the Riotti family. I think that there are a lot of achievements and a coherent vision that he had that kind of flew under the radar screen because of the scandals and also because of the complexity of what he was trying to do.
Your bottom line is that Bill Clinton gave the nation a serious and substantive presidency.
Yes, in domestic policy, absolutely. It was less serious and perhaps less substantive in foreign policy, although there were achievements there as well.
Mm-hmm. Take us into some of the aspects of the Clinton presidency that we've all just held our heads and tried to figure out whether we loved him or not. And of course, many people didn't. Many still do. Many didn't, and many still don't. He was a guy who brought out strong responses. But we want to take advantage of your close view of him. I guess first of all, his relationship with his own party. What was it all about? How did it end up?
Well, he was an inconvenience for his party. I mean, politicians like simple sentences, and Clinton was a walking compound interrogatory. I mean, what he was trying to do was take progressive governance into the next era, and he managed to spend 8 years in office and created only one new bureaucracy, the police corps, which was tiny and admirable and embraced by his successor. The rest of the things that he did through the tax code by giving tax credits to the working poor, daycare credits, college tuition credits, and also he confounded Democrats in other ways. You know, people talk about his character, about how, in journalistic circles, character is usually a euphemism for sex. Mm-hmm. But there are other aspects to character. And one of them in public life is whether you're willing to go against the views of your strongest supporters.
And on that count, you give him a great deal of credit.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he did it time and time again. He did it on free trade. He did it on welfare reform. He did it when he first came to office and decided to raise taxes in order to lower the budget deficit. Now, that was just a theory. Nobody knew if that would work, if that would have an impact on Wall Street, lower interest rates, and cause the economy to boom. He gambled his presidency on an abstraction.
And I guess
not
you give him the ultimate
would do that.
Right, and you give him the ultimate garland when you say he gambled and he won. He ultimately delivered for the very constituency that Democrats see themselves as representing.
He also did it. You know, he was not a coward in many ways, although people view him that way. In 1992, when he campaigned for the presidency, he would go to union halls to discuss his the fact that he was in favor of the North American Free Trade Agreement, that he was in favor of free trade, which the unions were vehemently against. You know, when Lane Kirkland of the AFL-CIO offered Clinton $2 million to, you know, for television advertising to promote Mrs. Clinton's health care plan, if Clinton would drop NAFTA, Clinton didn't drop NAFTA, and Lane Kirkland spent the money on ads opposing him. When he went to black audiences, to African-American audiences, he talked about crime. He talked about the disastrous consequences of single-parent families. He talked about the need for welfare reform.
Tough stuff, and yet he was embraced like crazy.
Because he didn't condescend. I mean, one of the dirty little secrets of liberalism is that it is. I've rarely heard liberal politicians say two simple words to an African-American constituent. I disagree. And Clinton would say that all the time.
His relationship with the Republicans.
Well, that was far more complicated. They hated him with a passion for two reasons. One, they hated him substantively because he took a fair number of their ideas, sanded off the rough edges, and implemented them. There, you know, there've been other presidents like that: Woodrow Wilson, Dwight Eisenhower, Richard Nixon, who implemented the Environmental Protection Agency. Mm-hmm. So, you know, Republicans thought he was a thief, and Democrats thought he was a Republican.
But you say they also hated him simply because he won the White House and he held on to it, and the Republicans thought they owned it.
Yes, and another part of that is that he was the exemplar of my, perhaps your generation, the baby boomers, and his faults were our faults to the nth degree, and so he became a symbolic figure in the culture wars. And Bob Dole, a very estimable, honorable man, when I asked him whether there were people in his party that just would never accept Bill Clinton, he said, yeah, there was a whole wing of the party that did not consider him a legitimate president from day one. Now, let's think about that for a second. The elections in 92 and 96 weren't nearly as close as the election in 2000. This guy was legitimately elected president of the United States. Mm-hmm. And while political opposition is justifiable, there was a level, an intensity, a ferocity of opposition that I think went to the point of being unpatriotic.
And there was something here that went beyond they're being angry because he stole the substance of the Republican agenda, something that even went beyond losing the White House, that almost seemed like a morality play being played out here over Bill Clinton's
character.
Yeah, well,
that was the culture war part of it. You know, in the ancient world, the scapegoat was always actually guilty of his or her crimes, and they were the crimes of the society. Well, Bill Clinton committed three major crimes in the eyes of the traditionalists. One was the obvious sex and self-indulgence, which was a baby boom crime. The other was, you know, he polled more than any other president, and it was putting marketing ahead of substance at times, as he did when he offered all kinds of little bite-sized proposals that polled well. And the third thing was kind of almost more spiritual, and that was that he was an ice skater. He fudged. He didn't serve or sacrifice. Being a politician was the only thing that he had ever done. Mm-hmm. And that was a distinct difference with the politicians of our parents' generation who had served, who had sacrificed. And they disdained not only Bill Clinton, they also disdained Newt Gingrich, who was, you know, the evil twin.
We're talking tonight about the Bill Clinton reality and the Bill Clinton legacy with Joe Klein, New Yorker staff writer who's just out with a new book called The Natural, The Misunderstood Presidency of Bill Clinton. What is the Clinton legacy to you? How did he work his magic, and does it still look like magic to you? Did it ever? What was the heart of the Clinton years? Can you still feel it beating? Do you want to? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joe Klein, give us some of the anecdotes, and you've got so many wonderful ones in the book, but some of the anecdotes that you found most illuminating about this man, this president.
Oh God, there were so many of them. I think that my favorite anecdote concerns their marriage, and it was told to me by the late Diane Blair, who was Mrs. Clinton's best friend. She went to visit Hillary Clinton at one point in the White House, and they were discussing Kyoto, which is, I suppose, what the First Lady discusses with her friends from time, you know, usually.
And why not?
Matters of substance rather than gossip or anything like that. At which point the president came in, and he and Mrs. Clinton got into a screaming fight about Kyoto, about the global warming treaty. Diane Blair is sitting there totally embarrassed. And when it looks like he's about to punch her out or something, he suddenly puts his arms around Mrs. Clinton and starts kissing her all over her face and saying, "What would I do without you?" I mean,
interpret that for us, Joe Klein. That is just a relationship so deep and broad that it can encompass both the screaming fight over policy and the next minute say, "You keep me alive."
Yeah. Well, you know, my position on the marriage, I don't know much more about the marriage than you do, but my position has been to be indiscriminately credulous. I believe everything. I believe that he messes around. I believe that they fight like harpies. I believe that they have a cold, political, calculated partnership. I believe that they're best friends. I believe that they love each other madly in every sense of the word. Those of you out there who are married know that that isn't such a stretch. You know, the ultimate test is, why are they still married? Mm-hmm. I mean, there's no political purpose to it now. Her poll ratings would probably go up if she dumped the guy. But they are married, and they go off on quiet vacations together for
a week
to the Dominican Republic in January. When I last spoke to him, he had just come back from a week with the senator.
Yeah. Senator Hillary Clinton. Yeah, that's great. Listeners, we're talking about Bill Clinton tonight. How does Bill Clinton live in your mind today? Demon, demigod, some mix of both? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Carol is on the line. Welcome, Carol. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm sort of curious because it seems like during Clinton's sexual peccadilloes during his presidency that the press focused on it incessantly, but when the public was really asked about it, it seemed like the public didn't really care.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was the press's obsession, not the public.
The polls always showed that.
Yeah, yet now, if you talk about Clinton to the public, people just kind of laugh about him as if he's just kind of a terminal womanizer. And that seems to be the lasting impression of him, even though when all of this was going on, when he was president, we were told that the public really didn't care. So I'm sort of puzzled why that remains his legacy in the mind of so many Americans.
Carol, that's a great question. Joe Klein, what do you think? You've looked so closely. Is the man growing or shrinking? And do you agree with Carol's observation that in some ways, post time in office, he's being reduced to the peccadilloes? Wouldn't that be a sorry end?
Yeah, you know, that is a very, very interesting observation. Maybe the most interesting observation I've heard in weeks about him, and I've been talking about him for weeks. I think that there's a lot to that, and I think that in part he set the trajectory on its way by the way he left the White House, the disgraceful way that he left the White House. In some ways, he was putting Lewinsky behind him. And people had come to – there was a final honeymoon, if you remember, where people were very fond of him. His approval ratings were high throughout his second term. And then he has to go and ruin it with all of those utterly ridiculous and, you know, unspeakable pardons.
So you think brought back the kind of judgmental, negative view of Clinton just as he left the White House?
Yeah. I mean, it made him seem, you know, petty and a semi-crook. People thought that he was doing it for the money. And I imagine that someone who is as susceptible to flattery as he is, money is flattery. And, you know, he had Beth Desoritz, the Democratic Party fundraiser, admitted to the White House 86 times in his last 2 years in office. I mean, that's, you know, it was like a courtiers in the Middle Ages.
Carol, I want to go back to Carol, our caller. Carol, what do you make of that explanation of why that image seems to linger in so many people's minds?
I'm not really sure. Part of it is kind of the talk show circuit or, you know, Imus or things like that still keep talking about, you know, he's got a love nest in Park Avenue or whatever. But I think it may have something to do with the pardons, but it seems more a real character issue in the way people talk about him.
Is that the lingering image for you, Carol, or what sticks with you of Bill Clinton?
I think that it is a lingering image. And I guess even more is if the reports are true that when he left the White House, they were kind of like, you know, taking everything inside. I'm not sure how much of that was true, but if even a shred of it is true, it just sounded so cheesy and crass that I guess my lasting impression of Bill Clinton is kind of Mr. Immediate Gratification. And so, I don't know. I don't have a good lasting impression of him. And I kind of tried to, but I must say that by the end of his two terms, I was exhausted. I mean, the 90s were exhausting. He made them exhausting.
He was marvelously exhausting for a lot of people. Joe Klein.
This is a really interesting discussion because, first of all, I guess he really was misunderstood because the things that he did for people who don't sup with Don Imus and the rest of the, the comedians. If you're going to college on a Hope scholarship now, or if you're a mom who was formerly on welfare and who's able to live and work now and have her kids get health care, that's all because of Bill Clinton. And he isn't a joke. He was a serious substantive president.
However, you're right, there was this needy, high cholesterol quality to it all.
Absolutely.
The public seemed enthralled by his vast, messy humanity. But in the end, we relate, as all media moguls know, humanity is what sticks with people, messy or not.
That's right. And it is the lingering impression because there isn't anything serious that he's doing now. You know, so everybody can make jokes. And he's kind of blown it by having these occasional meetings of his advisors where they talk about how to sell his legacy. Mm-hmm. You can't sell a legacy. You know, history bestows that or not. And so there's a kind of desperate quality to him. And there's a lot of unfair jokes. But I would add one other thing. Mm-hmm. There was a really rancid quality to the campaign against Bill Clinton among the radical Republicans and in the press. There was an awful lot of misinformation and disinformation and separating his behavior out from other presidents in ways that it shouldn't be. I mean, the White House, taking stuff out of the White House is a great example of that. You know, Clinton once gave me a statistic for how they built up the White House Preservation Trust during their 8 years in office. But they contributed millions and millions of dollars. Mrs. Clinton's books, you know, the royalties went to White House Preservation. So he
savaged for a few plates and forks, or maybe not forks, missing. And the fact that he built up the trust is glossed straight over.
Mm-hmm. But I will say that he certainly played into the worst perceptions of and the worst caricatures that his enemies, you know, set up for him. He was an incredibly needy guy. He was a guy with huge appetites and absolutely no self-discipline and extremely self-indulgent.
We'll be talking about all that. And plus, what kind of table Bill Clinton set for the future? We ran straight into 9/11 only a few months after he left. What was America's affair with Bill Clinton all about? Did he repel you, cast a spell on you? What was it all about? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're talking with Joe Klein, author of the new book, The Natural, The Misunderstood Presidency of Bill Clinton. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back in just a minute. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with Joe Klein. He wrote Primary Colors, and now he has a new book out, The Natural, The Misunderstood Presidency of Bill Clinton. What do you think? What is the Clinton legacy? How did he work his magic? And does it still look like magic to you? Did it ever? What was the heart of the Clinton years? Can you still feel it beating? Do you want to? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Barry is on the line. Welcome, Barry. You're on the air.
Hi, good evening. I think Mr. Klein would benefit all readers by reexamining his premise for the paperback edition. How can you claim that Clinton was a great domestic policy president? Look in the wake of September 11th of the number of domestic agencies that failed, the INS, the FAA. If Clinton really was the great domestic policy alchemist that Klein claims him to be, where are the accomplishments in those agencies which were part of the sort of projection, as Madeleine Albright or some Clintonista called it, the combination of soft power and hard power that you have to, that America had to sort of combine in dealing with foreign policy.
Barry, you're asking the tough question, and I think it's a fair one. How about it, Joe Klein? In the wake of September 11th, does it cast a new light on Clinton? Can he take the blame for the country not being prepared? What is it? How does the Clinton presidency and 9/11, how do they intersect in your mind?
Well, that's foreign policy. That isn't domestic policy.
And, maybe, but on the other hand, Barry's pointing to all the domestic agencies that were involved in a security lapse.
It's security policy. I've been talking about economic, the handling of the economy and social policy. But I also speak a great deal in the book about this very issue and how Clinton failed egregiously here. And in part it was that he never ever really had the confidence to handle the military and defense policy and security policy the way he did the economy. I think it was in part he was defensive about his own lack of a war record, but he didn't pay the attention to foreign policy that it needed. It was spotty. He felt that he could cram the way he did in law school and not care about various countries, and then all of a sudden at the last moment study up and then have a policy. Foreign policy depends on a very slow, layered, patient approach, and he's not a patient guy.
But at an even taller level,
let me just say this.
Okay, Joe.
I would say that the Lewinsky scandal had an absolute impact on our ability to suss out 9/11 before it happened. Mm-hmm. As Osama bin Laden came up on the radar screen in the mid-90s, members of Clinton's foreign policy team, like Sandy Berger, the national security advisor, and others, began to realize that the FBI was a total disaster. Clinton realized that, too. I think that they all wanted to fire Louis Freeh, the FBI director, but they could not do it because it would seem a Saturday night massacre.
Mm. But Joe Klein,
it would seem that he was firing him over Lewinsky.
Over Lewinsky.
And I do believe that, you know, that he can absolutely be faulted for not
getting his own hands tied, not then being able to pursue what he should have pursued. Let me ask you this. Bill Clinton.
He's a president. Mm. Your hands are never really tied when you're president. You could take the hit and explain what you want to do. I mean, it would have been very difficult to get the American people aroused about the terrorist threat and, before September 11th. But he was a remarkably talented politician. He could do it. And they knew how terrible the FAA was. And they knew how terrible the INS was because of Al Gore's reinventing government process.
Step back even another step with us. Bill Clinton talked endlessly about building a bridge to the 21st century. But looking at it from the vantage point post 9/11, you can hear Republicans saying this guy was living in a dream world. What he saw as the 21st century is not what was ever there, is not what's going to be there. How do you read that? Is that just a Republican view of the world taking hold? Was Bill Clinton right about the globalism that he saw emerging? Or did he somehow have it wrong? Was he missing something fundamental that led to 9/11 or that informs our world post 9/11?
The answer to all of that is yes. I mean, you know, he was missing something, but he also had something.
Mm-hmm.
And, if that is the Republican argument, and it's only the argument of extremely stupid Republicans, then it is very simplistic. Clearly, Clinton did not see what was coming down the pike in terms of national security. That he will be faulted for in history. That was a major, major problem. However, he did see the global economy. He was the first globalist president, and he acted on that in very sophisticated ways. I think that the record is mixed. We have to see what's going to happen with this so-called war on terrorism.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You know, was September 11th an isolated event? Will there be others like it? Will we be prepared for it? Will it be a major crisis, you know, ongoing crisis? Nobody knows yet.
We're watching. Steve is calling from Amherst, New Hampshire. Welcome, Steve. You're on the air.
Boy, you know, I've been listening to this for a half an hour, and there are so many cross currents and so many places to go. But thanks for a terrific program as usual.
Sure.
In general, I started out thinking what you've got here is a situation where the Europeans were wondering why we would help to destroy a president who had helped aimed us towards a target of making as much as we can out of our good fortune, the fact that we had an economy that was going great guns. And they were wondering why the press and the public were willing to conspire for the very same reason that they elected this guy, that he captivated people, mm-hmm. now they were willing to let the press bring him down.
So what question and does that leave you with, Steve?
Well, the question it brings me down is, in Europe, when clearly we're not in Europe, but a guy who tried to be a global president and tried to listen to the sense of the world was really brought down by the most simplistic issues. And even now, 14 months after his presidency, we're talking more about his personality than about his accomplishments. Will we ever be able to command the attention to the deed of being president rather than the style of being president?
Steve, thanks for your call, and I guess tonight we're really trying to look at both. But how about it, Joe Klein? It always comes back to this. It's Carol's question again, and you really do it in the book, and we have to give you credit for that. But Steve says, does this guy's personality so gangly and huge that it's always going to stand in front of his accomplishments?
The answer is no. I think that ultimately he's going to be known as a successful domestic policy president mm-hmm. and unsuccessful foreign policy president, but both of those achievements are going to be dwarfed by the times in which he lived. And I think that when people look back on the 90s and also the 80s, when they look back on the special prosecutor era after Watergate, they're going to see that Washington was a town that went slightly berserk, mm-hmm. that there were all these investigations. There was an attempt to criminalize politics. The press cheered it on and slipped from its natural skepticism into utter cynicism. And it was a very dangerous period for democracy. I don't know how we get that genie back in the bottle, but I'll tell you something. The effect of
the war
this,
would be one way, and it seems to be being used to some extent to do that right now, doesn't it?
Yeah, but we don't have a war.
Well,
yes and no. We have a police action in Afghanistan following an atrocity, mm-hmm. but I don't know whether you could actually call that a war. We'll see what happens.
Mm-hmm. Joe, stand by. I want to get one more call here. Alan's calling from Erie, Pennsylvania. Welcome, Alan. You're on the air.
How you doing?
Well, thanks, Alan.
Basically, it's kind of interesting listening since I first called in. My point was had a little bit to do with the whole Lewinsky thing. My father has a great point he made. If Mr. Clinton would have been the janitor, she wouldn't have paid him any attention.
Well, fair enough. Power has its attraction, but where are you going with that, Alan?
But the other the point that I wanted to follow on there with was, and it's kind of one that developed from the last couple of conversations, is I believe Clinton did try to do a lot more, but he kept running into what you might call a hostile Congress. I mean, I remember news and everything being covered that we were doing foreign policy things with the military over in Europe, and I remember sending ships in and bombing Afghanistan. And then all of a sudden Congress said, no, call them all back.
Alan, thanks for your call. Joe Klein, how about it? Bill Clinton and the Congress?
Well, I think he got an awful lot out of the Congress, but we just never noticed it. Even in 1998, the Lewinsky year, he was getting $100 million here and a billion there for various programs that especially affected the working poor. Mm-hmm. You know, just to finish my thought from before, mm-hmm. I think that the Clinton era is going to be remembered more for the ferocity of its prosecutions than for the severity of its crimes. And those sorts of eras are not remembered fondly in history. And I think that the fact that he never faced a great crisis, that it was an unprecedented period of peace and prosperity, meant that there was never a chance that he was going to be regarded as a great president, because in politics, in governance, greatness is always thrust upon you by the crisis of the moment. George Bush has had one and has responded well, I think. But Clinton never had that opportunity. And so he was always going to be regarded somewhere in the middle. But the fact that there was so little crucial business to be done during those years
because
left
they were
a
fat
lot
and
of
happy
leeway.
Years.
Left a lot of leeway for the press to kill, for newspapers to kill vast forests in pursuit of the truth of Whitewater, which was trivial, and a great many other scandals. The FBI files, nothing happened. No one was ever indicted. There were six special prosecutors sicked on various cabinet members in the Clinton administration, and nothing was ever found.
Joe Klein, we're just about out of time here, and we're sorry for it because there's so much more we could get into with you. But thanks so much for your new book, The Natural, The Misunderstood Presidency of Bill Clinton. And thanks for being with us tonight, Joe Klein.
My pleasure.
You can read the first chapter of Joe Klein's book, The Natural, on our website at onpointradio.org. Like Bill Clinton before him, President Bush is pushing for programs that foster volunteerism in America. Megan McIntyre was one of the many people who volunteered with the Red Cross after September 11th. She was between jobs and saw working with the organization as a good way to fill up time. But since she began in October, she says she's found the work more fulfilling than she could ever have imagined.
What made me interested in getting involved with disaster services was that a disaster can happen to anyone. And you never know when you or one of your friends or someone you know is going to need help. A friend of mine had a house fire, and the Red Cross responded to her home in the middle of the night and made sure that she had a place to stay, made sure that she had clothes to wear, made sure that she had something to eat. So primarily I've been responding to house fires. What it means is that you are available on a particular night during the week. So when you get called in the middle of the night, you're in bed and you think, oh, well, it would be nice to stay in bed. But then you also think that there's someone out there who's just had their house burned down, who may not have any clothes to wear, who may have no place to go. And that's what motivates you to get out of bed and go respond to this fire. I went in January to New York, and I was there for 3 weeks as a volunteer working in the New Jersey Family Assistance Center. I met with families who'd been directly affected by the disaster. Either they'd lost family members in the World Trade Center attack. It was a very rewarding, but it was also a very intense experience. One family in particular that I met with, a woman had lost her son in the World Trade Center. And she came into the center because she just wanted to talk to somebody. I got back a month ago, and it feels like it was a really long time ago. I think it's something that I'm going to carry with me for the rest of my life. It's made me more of a compassionate person. It's made me realize how much I'm part of a larger community and how there may be things going on with someone that you don't necessarily know. You don't know that person, but he or she may be suffering some sort of loss. There may be a way you can help that person that you don't know about yet. I do plan to continue volunteering even after I start working again. It's really easy to get caught up in your job and your life and your friends in whatever you're doing, but I can stay connected to the larger community and be helping people that need my help. When I started volunteering, I thought of it as a way to use my time. What I didn't realize is what I would be getting out of it, a really intense sense of purpose in my life and working with other people and really being able to help someone else who has a problem, even in a simple way, such as giving them clothes to wear or shoes to put on their feet.
Megan McIntyre lives in Cambridge, Massachusetts. To listen to other diaries or to submit an idea or an essay of your own, visit our website at onpointradio.org. These diaries often start with an email from you. Send your ideas, questions, or short essays to onpoint@wbur.org. Or you can mail us. The address is On Point, WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to On Point. This is WBUR.